is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and associate producer Stephanie Collins. As I've told you over and over again, we are now doing this by Zoom. So the conversation we're having is actually being recorded on Wednesday to air on Thursday. Before I begin our interviews, you've come to expect this because we've been doing it now for months. You are going to hear the words of Colonel Vindman in November of 2019 when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing. And as I have said ad nauseum, it was not only not all right for him, it is not all right for the rest of us. These are the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Back by popular demand is Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst, the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA and National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and a whistleblower at the CIA. His most recent book is American Carnage. He is also the national security columnist for Counterpunch. The reason, at least the raison d'être initially, that I wanted to grab Mel is that his piece at Counterpunch was entitled The Coronavirus and the Urgent Need to Redefine National Security. So let me welcome back to the program my old friend Mel Goodman. How are you, Mel?
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be with you, of course.
It's a pleasure. So I was going through my Twitter feed, and before we jump into your article, the reason I want to share this with you is that in some ways it really sort of speaks to why it's so difficult for us to change the sort of bad investments we've made, the inability to do the kind of oversight we need, how to redirect funds, because it's a challenge, especially during a presidential campaign, to be able to have these conversations that are so important. This is an amazing story, and I just wanted you to hear it. Democrats say Google's COVID-19 ad ban is a gift to Donald Trump. And it turns out that what I wrote as I Facebooked it, I wrote, why is Google aiding and abetting the liar in chief? His denial, delay, and deception should not go unchecked during this election season. And then basically what has happened is he is not allowing political candidates to mention or discuss COVID-19, which is something that has the potential to dramatically bolster Trump's and Republicans' chances of re-election. Senator Chris Murphy is the senator from Connecticut who tweeted this out, Mel. And he wrote, this seems to be a very big story. Google apparently is refusing to allow candidates to criticize President Trump's coronavirus situation. And as a result, what I am so concerned about, Mel, is you're talking about all the bad investments, all the way we need to redirect our funds, redefining national security. COVID-19 has exposed so many weaknesses. And you would think that these are the conversations you'd want to have as you run for US Senate, as you run for governor, as you run for president. And Google, which is such an important place to place ads, is now restricting any kind of criticism of the president. Is this legal? Does this make sense? And this, to me, seems to be such an important vulnerability for the president because it's putting the country at risk, and frankly, it's putting the world at risk.
Well, this is an incredible outrage, but if you look at what authoritarian societies are doing, and we have an authoritarian president, if not an authoritarian society, they are using this crisis to enforce illegal measures. Now, whether it's Orban in Hungary or Netanyahu in Israel, who took advantage of the virus to enhance his election capabilities, or Trump using the power of the presidency every day in prime time to spread propaganda, why in the world Google would lend itself to official censorship and a cover-up is alarming, but it's really part of the loss of liberty we've been suffering ever since we began this war on terror, whether it's the way the FBI abuses powers of investigation or the illegal use of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court or newspapers that are refusing to criticize this president. So we have an alarming situation, the kind that Eisenhower warned about when he said, every time you're in protracted war, you are going to lose liberty. You are going to lose personal freedom. And that's exactly what's happening in this country today. So we're focusing on the wrong enemies anyway. The enemies aren't international. The enemies aren't Russia and China and rogue states. We've overemphasized those points of vulnerability. The enemies are at home. I've seen the enemy and he is us. It's what Pogo warned us about decades ago. So the enemies are internal. It's this virus. It's cyber warfare. It's the denial of all of the inequality in our society, the denial of the opioid crisis, the suicide crisis, the depression crisis in our society, all being worsened by the virus itself and the pandemic. For Google to lend itself to this is an outrage. It's unconscionable.
We are finding out that the enemy, in fact, is us. And Donald Trump has been very good at othering everything. He others immigrants, others Muslims, he others China. Whatever is convenient, he does this. But the reason why I wanted to bring in this idea of what the Google ads were doing, Google is whatever genuflecting to this president, which means they must be terrified of him. But there's also something that just came out too. Donald Trump is now sending out this sort of campaign piece of material that says, please sign our official petition right now to demand that fake news continue airing President Trump's daily press conference. I am looking at this Oreo cookie, Mel, where we're being squeezed everywhere. Google is now not allowing us to criticize. Donald Trump is requiring people to petition because he's having these daily press conferences that are, I think, a replacement for his campaign events, and basically ordering the press to cover it. Whether there's valuable content or no content, it doesn't matter. And you're absolutely right. There is this authoritarian streak in Donald Trump. But now it's not only impacting our ability to exercise our democracy, I think it is putting us at such incredible risk because so many of the Republicans are following him lockstep, even if what he is asking them to do is dangerous and will undermine our ability to really address COVID-19. It's shocking on so many levels.
Well, Trump has learned something that allows him to take advantage of the dumbing down of the American society. Which is that weak presidents and bad presidents can take advantage of bad wars, and we're involved in a war now, to enhance their reelection. Richard Nixon was reelected overwhelmingly during the Vietnam War. George W. Bush was reelected during the unpopular Iraq War, which was based entirely on lies. And now Trump has learned that he can use the virus to become what he calls himself a wartime president. Because he knows this country will rally around the flag. We do that. We've rallied around this outrageous defense budget, this bloated defense budget that now gets bipartisan majorities. And it's pointless to talk about Republicans because there's really no Republican Party. John Boehner said it best. There is no Republican Party. It is a Trump Party. And there isn't anything Mitch McConnell wouldn't do in the Senate or Kevin McCarthy in the House to enhance Trump's reelection capability. And now when you look at Trump using this national network that he's co-opted for himself in a very strategic way, prime time, every night around 5:30, when people usually are tuning in for national news, they're tuning in and getting Donald Trump spilling falsehoods to the American public. This is worse than anything you see in Russia, because even Putin is now not making the announcements about the virus in Russia. He's letting underlings do it because he doesn't want to be blamed for the consequences. And I think the only reason why Trump even extended the shelter in place from Easter, when we're all going to go to church, till the end of the month, is because Lindsey Graham said a lot of people are going to die, and those deaths are going to be on your...
But even his language of sheltering in place, it's a suggestion. It's a suggestion. He's not telling all 50 governors to do this. You see what's going on in Texas. You see what's going on in so many states where so many of the Republican governors are not playing by this game, where they're inviting, you know, the virus to sort of show up. I mean, people are still going to church in Texas.
Well, that's because there's no federal policy on anything. And the one thing you have to remember when you look at Stephen Bannon and the role he played before he was ousted from the White House is he wanted the deconstruction of the administrative state. Well, that's exactly what we've had. We've had a hollowing out of the government. Enough attention hasn't been paid to this. We've hollowed out all the departments of national security. We've hollowed out the important regulatory agencies. We've ruined the Environmental Protection Agency, which was created, not created by a liberal or a Democrat. It was created by Richard Nixon.
I know.
Lawyers are fleeing. Engineers are fleeing from EPA. Over 500 people have left the White House staff since he was inaugurated. That's an 80% turnover. We have never seen anything like that in history. You're on your fifth director of the Department of Homeland Security, and he's an acting director. And in his most recent testimony before the Congress, he couldn't say how many ventilators and respirators and BiPAP machines were in the Homeland Security process and what the inventory was on personal protective equipment. So what Trump has done to get around the constitutional need for advised consent of important cabinet officials, he's either left positions blank or he's made acting directors. Everywhere you look, there's either an acting director or a lobbyist, or you get a fraud like Pompeo as Secretary of State, who went to the G7 meeting and tried to totally politicize it to isolate China, and the Europeans weren't buying it. So here's the United States in this rotating presidency, the head of the G7, and we haven't exercised any leadership whatsoever. So when you think of the traditional role of an American president to orchestrate the international community and international organizations, we see nothing from the international organizations, including the United Nations and the Security Council and the other international bodies that have been created, because the United States isn't playing the leadership role. It's been America first. It's been unilateralism. It's been ultranationalism. And now we're living in a world of ultranationalism, and that kind of nationalism can't fight a globalized pandemic, an international pandemic, which is what we're faced with. So the American people are going to suffer from every aspect of Trump's lack of leadership.
I posted something on my Facebook page. I pulled it from your article. And I just want people to hear this number because people were like shocked. You wrote, "Now at a time when there are no serious challenges from abroad to U.S. security or military supremacy, more than 60% of U.S. discretionary spending goes to support defense, including the budgets of the Pentagon, VA, intelligence, energy, and homeland security. No other agency in the U.S. government gets as much as 10% of U.S. discretionary spending. And Trump's current budget calls for cutting the budgets of domestic agencies such as HHS, Health and Human Services, Education, Housing and Urban Development even further." If nothing else, the reason why that story I told you about Google and the ads and that we can't criticize the response to COVID-19, this is exactly why we have to criticize the response to COVID-19. Because basically all the money has been sucked into the defense budget. It has made us vulnerable on every level. We're seeing that we spend more money on healthcare, but we don't spend more money on healthcare. We spend more money on every operation, on every insurance company, on every specialist doctor, on every prescription drug, like 5 times and 10 times as much as every other country in the world. It's not about healthcare we're spending. It's on health profits that we're spending. And then you see what the government is investing in, and it's draining all those dollars and exploding the Pentagon budget. For what? We are now defenseless against the most important enemy we've ever faced, which is, he keeps talking about, the invisible enemy. Well, if it's the invisible enemy, take some of the money out of the Pentagon and give it to HHS. But that's not how we operate.
We keep talking about an arms race, but the fact of the matter is we're in an arms race with ourselves.
Yes.
No one else is in an arms race with us. If you look at the military footprint, that's the international footprint of the U.S. military. It is global. It's 700 to 800 military facilities around the world. Some of these are huge bases, like some of them in the Persian Gulf and Middle East, in addition to the ones in Europe and South Korea and Japan. Right. Russia has two modest facilities outside of the former Soviet space, and those are those naval and air facilities in Syria, which aren't grandiose by any measure. China has one military facility, and that's they put that in Djibouti to help us fighting the war on piracy around the Horn of Africa.
Right, the Horn of Africa.
We're international. We completely dominate the sea. We completely dominate the air. But yet we've allocated $1.7 trillion over the next 10 years for modernization of nuclear weapons. We shouldn't be modernizing nuclear weapons. We should be finding a way to get back to the arms control table, which Trump, of course, abandoned with the help of John Bolton when he went after the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that was negotiated by Ronald Reagan, of all people, a very conservative president. So we're putting money into things like the F-35. That's $1.5 trillion. Even the late Senator John McCain said he got sticker shock when he saw what the F-35 was going to cost. So it's an outrage. And but, Democrats support these defense budgets too. They're bipartisan majorities.
All right, so let me just say something, and you make a really good point. Again, we're talking with Mel Goodman, his piece at Counterpunch, the coronavirus and the urgent need to redefine national security. God, this is the time to have the most vibrant presidential campaign, and we see nothing. We see nothing. The only kind of allusion to another side other than Donald Trump is to hear Andrew Cuomo, but he's not going to be talking about this. He's going to be talking about what's happening to his state, which is the epicenter of COVID-19. One of the things you said is part of the problem with Democrats supporting these bloated budgets is they see it as an employment opportunity. This isn't about defense. It's about jobs. It's and people need to say, I don't want this frickin' job, Mel. You know, the job I want is a job that will protect my air, protect my water, a job that goes into infrastructure, a job that will educate my kid. Instead, you've got Democrats agreeing to this because they can say, I'm bringing home the bacon. No, they're not. They're bringing home the failure.
Well, think of the so-called debates. They weren't really debates. There were these screaming matches. National security and defense spending and the defense budget never came up in these debates. It was rarely touched on. And you don't have any real expertise. And even the Democrats have a very weak security bench in this matter in terms of people they can bring forward. They can certainly bring better people than what we have in terms of Pompeo at State or Gina Haspel, who I consider a war criminal, who's the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, or this fraud Grinnell, who's now the acting chief of intelligence, the so-called intelligence czar. He's already sort of making changes at the director of National Intelligence Office when he hasn't even been confirmed. And the lack of confirmation is Trump's way of getting around the constitutional provision for advising consent. So the Congress has no role, and they haven't been forceful enough or aggressive enough or tenacious enough to go after all of these defense issues. I think there's a general intimidation in this country ever since 9/11. That's how they all voted for the Iraq War. They knew the Iraq War was a fraud. They weren't believing that fraudulent CIA estimate from October 2002, but they gave Bush the votes he wanted. Hillary Clinton did, Joe Biden did, John Kerry did. It was an outrage.
But Mel, this is the time to talk about it. This is the time, because the enemy that we're facing now is an enemy, as you pointed out, that's domestic. It's global, but what it's pointing out is all our domestic failures, all of them, all our lack of investment. People are shocked at what isn't available. People bought the lie, and now is an opportunity to compare.
The American Society of Civil Engineers, in their most recent study of American infrastructure, gave our infrastructure nationally a grade of D+. So they were talking about our bridges, our roads, our water management system, our overall infrastructure. It needs trillions of dollars of investment. Where have we put trillions of dollars? In Iraq and Afghanistan. Some say as much as $6 trillion has gone into Iraq and Afghanistan. We're still sending Afghanistan, which has nothing to do with American national security because we have no goals there. We have no objectives there. We've already lost. We're still putting in $4 billion a month in this very corrupt society. And what has fed the corruption? The American dollar. We've created the corruption pool that they're taking advantage of. And now we're trying to get out with this phony peace plan. But when you have one foot out the door, you're not going to negotiate on your terms.
There were two things that I keep thinking about. There was a article a couple of months ago about how the Pentagon had made, I don't know how many trillions of accounting changes within the Pentagon in 1 year. Like trillions of accounting changes. Like they were moving money around and moving pots around. I'm like, trillions. I'm like, I want the people to understand there's no trillions to move around in HHS. There's no trillions to move around in the EPA. And yet they are moving trillions around. We don't even know where the dollars go, Mel.
Until last year, the Defense Department was the only agency of government that never had an audit. So finally, they did an audit and they failed the audit. The Secretary of Defense, well, when it was Bob Gates, he said he had no idea what his own office spent, just the office of the Secretary of Defense. I don't think anyone has any idea of what the Pentagon actually spends and what they allocate and how they give out contracts for these outrageous weapon systems and how generals retire and they go to Lockheed Martin. They go to Northrop. And again, this
is revolving door.
The other part of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex, in addition to losing political liberty and civil liberty in times of crisis. He was right about all of these things. The farewell address from 1961 is must reading because that's the world we're living in now, the world that Eisenhower predicted.
As I'm looking at this, and you said we're so weak on this, I mean, we have probably one of the weakest candidates running for president. I'm looking at Joe Biden, and I don't know what I see.
Weaker than McGovern? No. Weaker than Dukakis? No.
Yeah.
I mean, the Democrats, let's face it, the Democrats have put up extremely weak personalities. And what's sad to me is every morning I tune in Andrew Cuomo. He's giving these talks every morning and they're really training sessions for Donald Trump, that Donald Trump should watch these to learn how a president behaves, what presidential leadership is, how do you talk to the American people. It's sort of the modern cyber version of the fireside chat of FDR. I'm finding he's very effective.
Well, Mel, I described him as our Desmond Tutu, our Vaclav Havel, I feel like I listen to him and all he's doing is really giving people the facts, being incredibly brutal about it. There's something comforting about actually knowing the numbers. Exactly. There's something comforting about actually knowing what to anticipate.
Because this is a key element. It's all about trust. People have to trust their government. I think people trust Andrew Cuomo because he's been direct, he's been colloquial, he's been straight from the shoulder. No one trusts Donald Trump. And now if you look at other societies, why did the Soviet Union collapse the way it did? Because the people no longer trusted their leaders. They no longer believed their leaders. But if you have societies, whether they're democratic societies like South Korea or authoritarian societies like Singapore, which had been very successful in handling this crisis. Yeah. Part of it was because the people trusted the government. They trusted their leaders to tell them the truth. And when they were told to shelter in place, they did indeed shelter in place. But if you have a lack of trust, which you have in authoritarian societies, which you have, well, in Israel, Netanyahu is a typical authoritarian leader who poses as a Democrat. He's taken advantage of this crisis to stay out of jail. He's been indicted for crying out loud.
I know.
Have an impeached president here, an indicted president there. And they're the best of friends.
I know. Mel Goodman writes for Counterpunch. He is their national security columnist, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. It has been too long, Mel Goodman. We need to beat this drum. I'm putting it on Facebook. And I think if nothing else, if we can at least give people the facts that may not be coming out of the candidates, we can at least infuse them to understand what they should demand in November of 2020, and then after that election, assuming that Donald Trump is replaced.
So, Mel Goodman, don't drop your guard.
I promise I won't. Take care. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Preventing water pollution from fertilizers on this current cast. Dumping fertilizer on your garden may do more harm than good. Nitrate and fertilizer can leach into water, posing a health risk, or make its way to the coast, causing excessive and often toxic algae growth.
Nitrate is a very leaky nutrient. It's difficult to keep it in place, so when you apply nitrogen fertilizer, there is the potential, if you get excessive rainfall, for it to move out of the system.
That's Carl Rosen, a soil scientist at the University of Minnesota. He suggests minimizing the problem by getting your soil tested so that you choose the appropriate fertilizer, then apply it in smaller batches. The key is to use what your plants need, but nothing more. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Hey there, Corona, what's it like in New York City? Heard you got 4,000 cases, man, that number's pretty. What to do? No toilet paper by the loo, can't make a poo. Hey there, Corona, times are getting pretty hard. Can't believe that just 3 weeks ago was paying bills with this guitar. Now things are bad. Can't pay my rent, it's pretty sad. My landlord's mad. Oh, I'm stuck in quarantine. No, don't want COVID-19. Oh, I'm stuck in quarantine. No, don't want COVID-19. The salt just seems so bizarre, cause we got planes and trains and cars, and that's exactly where you seem to stay. We all just made fun of you, we'd laugh because we kind of knew you wouldn't really come here anyway. Corona, I can promise you that by the time that we get through, the world will never ever be the same, and you're to blame. No, I don't. Oh, I'm stuck in quarantine. No, don't want COVID-19. Don't want COVID now. Oh, no. No, I don't. No, I don't. No, I don't.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and associate producer Stephanie Collins. We're going to be talking about detention centers. We're going to be talking about ICE. We're going to be talking about immigrants. We're going to be talking about refugees. We're going to be talking about all those things. This is a conversation we've had a lot on my show. And before I grab my guest, who is a writer at ProPublica, which we totally adore, and also this article was shared with the Texas Tribune, I wanted to start with a note that came from one of my listeners at KPFT in Houston, Texas. The note came in about maybe 6 days ago. Here's what the note said. The disaster I see coming within the next few days is when the virus hits the overcrowded and medically ignored immigrant detention facilities all along the border and far inland. The ones run by El Gilio, I guess that means ICE, are bad enough. The ones run by the private prison folks who've been making bank off Trump's anti-immigration hysteria are going to turn into death camps in the immediate future. The for-profit prisons have been making large bucks off of crowding asylum seekers who are not illegal, at least in the America I grew up in and spent 4 years in the blue serving, under inhumane conditions, as well as documented by AOC and others. These very profitable corps hire guards in the local community, i.e., uneducated rednecks who speak less Spanish than I do, which is really saying something, close paren. When, not if, the virus hits the overcrowded cells, which have been petri dishes since day one, the guards are just going to quit going to work. Crowded, locked up populations who are left unattended and closely confined are going to die in droves. It will take a couple of weeks at best for the National Guard to show up, by which time we are going to have a lot of dead moms and kids in our conscience. Did they die of the virus, or did they die of starvation, thirst, and cholera due to being neglected and abandoned? We will probably never know, because disposing of the bodies will be a top health priority. I am not exaggerating. Trust me, this is what you will see. This is a note that came in to me from one of my listeners at KPFT. Joining us right now is the author of a piece at ProPublica entitled, As Coronavirus Infections Spread, So Have Clashes Between ICE Detainees and Guards. At ICE detention camps across the country, unrest is growing as detainees warn that dirty conditions and a disturbing lack of soap and other supplies could allow coronavirus to run rampant. Perla Treviso?
That's correct.
Good, is joining us. Perla, I read his note. I read your article. I am beside myself. because I think his hysteria is something that will not surprise you as you put together this piece, because it sounds like we are anticipating this. The problem is, what capability do we have to respond to it? Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what you are seeing with this sort of tension between ICE and obviously the people that they are quote unquote responsible for at these detention centers.
I think as the number of coronavirus confirmed cases rise, so does the fear and uncertainty inside this immigration detention center. So we've been hearing a lot more about people going on hunger strike, for example, as another colleague in ProPublica reported, because they were demanding more soap, for instance. We're hearing of the protests such as the one described in the article here in Texas, where I think 60 detainees protested and led to, I think, at least 9 of them being punished in some way. So as they hear news about coronavirus and the number of cases spreading, that is seeping in through the centers, and you know, there might be watching it on TV or hearing it from relatives from outside. So they're responding by, you know, demanding to be let out, to be put. I spoke, for example, to 2 women, and they're saying, you know, we're not criminals. They can release us to our families with an ankle bracelet. Like they were terrified of what could happen if they get a positive case inside one of the centers.
Well, one of the things that I think is so amazing is that we're recognizing this problem at Rikers. We're recognizing this problem within our prison system. And these are people who are either awaiting trial or have been convicted. So there is some sort of connection between criminal activity, and they're talking about releasing a lot of these people because of the concerns about what's going to happen with COVID, because they don't have the ability to move around. They are basically caged to die. That's what this is. They're caged. At least even in those settings, they may even have more space and more health opportunities than what we're seeing at the detention centers. I cannot understand why nobody is looking at these individuals, because we have a history of allowing them to, you know, to go back into society for a while. Virtually all of them, I think 98% of them, show up for their hearing. So it's known that they come back. What we are doing now is a level of inhumanity that, I hate to use this word, but it feels a little bit like Germany. I mean, you know what the result is going to be. It may not be that you gas them. It may not be that you burn them, but you know what the result is going to be. If this goes rampant, who is going to then allow them out? Where are they going to go when they go out? And if as this gentleman wrote me from KPFT, the audience, these guards are not going to want to show up because they don't want to put their lives at risk. I mean, I am just horrified at the potential here. And I'm just trying to figure out, I think there's a lawsuit now. I think it's being challenged, but who is hearing it?
I mean, it is being challenged. And from the government perspective, you know, it's not up to me to say what's right or what's wrong, but what the government is saying, that they're following CDC guidelines, that they're implementing measures to, you know, check people's temperature and make sure they're fine. They say that they have plans in place to self-isolate people. I mean, that's from that side, from the advocates and even some lawmakers. They are calling for the release of people, especially the most vulnerable population, because as they say, you know, if they do get sick and they need a hospital bed, as the numbers increase, less of those will be available. And so that's kind of what you're getting from what the government is saying that they're doing and what advocates and some and elected officials are calling for the government to do.
So all the pictures I've seen, I don't see 6 feet apart. All the pictures I've seen is hundreds of people with 4 bathrooms. All the pictures I've seen, I mean, everything I have seen up until COVID says they're lying. And that because of COVID, they suddenly have gotten more humane. They've suddenly gotten, they're spacing them better. They're giving them more bathrooms. I mean, you know, none of that is true. I just saw an article that said a lawsuit was filed in Washington, D.C. by legal groups, including the Rapid Defense Network, RACES, ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, demanding the government immediately release families detained at the agency's family residential centers across the country. So we know this is happening. And if people are raising concerns about what's happening in our prisons, this in some ways has an even greater density potential. This is about young children and mothers. I mean, the populations we're talking about are the most vulnerable. And to me, this is an opportunity to raise a level of inhumanity that is just both shocking and in some ways, as my friend Jim says, so damn predictable.
Yes, and I think that's exactly the point, that when you're in a detention center, you know, and the same arguments are being used in some of the jails, including in Harris County, where I reside, that, you know, it's hard to really abide for the 6 feet rule, for example, or the level of hygiene that experts are recommending that we undertake to prevent the spread of this virus. So they're saying when you're in a detention setting, of course, it's not possible to follow those guidelines as we all need to be following them. And that's the concern from the women that I've talked to inside the detention center here in Texas, that, you know, they see more migrants being processed. They, in their view, are not being checked adequately, or you know, for, I think that at most they take their temperature. They describe people who are coughing or even staff who might be showing signs of a cold, for instance. And so that's why they worry, and in their opinion, you know, and many others, that conditions are far from optimal.
So I would love to do a little bit of a follow-up. And so I know that we're worried about their temperatures. Do we know if anyone in any of these detention centers has had access to a test?
I do not know, and that's something that we've been asking, because I can't remember who was saying that, you know, tests are limited, period.
So it
would be hard to imagine that they have unlimited access to tests, right, because everyone is struggling with that, and ICE is part of that. So we do not know. And then the other, I think, concern is that not everyone shows, you know, when they take
signs,
their temperature or
exactly.
symptoms.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's a growing concern as well overall.
Well, I mentioned that there was this lawsuit filed in Washington, D.C. I just want to read a little bit from the press release, if you don't mind. And they said, these organizations are representing immigrant families who have sought protection from persecution and torture. Remember that, everyone. That is the rationale for them coming here. They are looking for protection from persecution and torture. And this is my aside. That doesn't mean that our job is to persecute them and torture them. I feel like in some ways what they ran from is now what they're running into, which is in the United States. Anyway, they continue. And who are detained in ICE custody civilly at the Burks Family Detention Center, the Carnes Family Detention Center, and the Dilley Family Detention Center. And they go through this list. These three FRCs are the only immigration family detention centers in the United States. Each have failed to take adequate measures to protect detained families from COVID-19. There is no justification for risking these families' health and safety. Doing so also risks the increasingly strained local healthcare systems and the American healthcare system at large. Should these families contract COVID-19 while detained, and so my concern, I go back to, is one, I'm sure they don't have access to tests. My concern is, you know, these guards aren't being paid well. You know, these guards basically are as afraid of them in some ways as they are afraid of the disease. And I do think that that's another concern, is not only what happens with COVID-19, but what happens with the kind of, quote, people that are supposed to be doing the oversight of these detention centers. Because once it becomes obvious that they're spread, they're not. They didn't sign up as medical workers. They didn't sign up as EMTs. They basically signed up to warehouse people. And when you're warehousing people, there's not a lot of skin in the game. And I think that's another reason why your story is so important. It's not only about the tension, it's about the potential result.
And that's, so far ICE has 4 cases of confirmed immigrant detainees with confirmed coronavirus. They also have a handful of workers, and then I that directly work with detainees, and then another subset of workers, of personnel, who have so far tested positive. But I think as the numbers spread in our society as a whole, that obviously is becoming an increasing concern for people who are detained, in this case, in immigration facilities.
Well, I'm hoping that you do some more follow-up on this. And the most important question is, Name me one person who's gotten a test. I want to know if there's anyone in those detainees. I mean, just one is, I would be amazed by. And of course, a lot of this is happening inside of Texas, where you have Governor Abbott, who hasn't necessarily followed the sort of strict response that you're seeing in places like, you know, Washington State, New York, and whatever. So you already have a governor who is sort of reluctant to sort of protect his state as a state. And when it comes to the whole detention centers, they're at the back of the bus. You know, and that's problematic.
And to be fair, it's beyond Texas, right? So we've been, there's videos from Louisiana, for example, of a group of Cubans, that video that was leaked of them, you know, asking for help. You've had people in Florida. And yes. So I think those videos on social media or being leaked are popping up more and more of people from inside of the centers trying to ask for help or bring attention to this issue.
So I will follow up with you on when we get to that, but you also had another story. And this is interesting because your explanation is fascinating because a lot of people did respond in a very negative way. This is from March 21st, your piece. It was entitled, "Here's Why Florida Got All the Emergency Medical Supplies It Requested While Other States Did Not." And you and I both know, as soon as we heard that the governor had requested, you know, X, Y, and Z, and then he actually got X, Y, and Z, when every other governor is sort of screaming out there, everyone said, ah, Trump is now a resident of Florida. Ah, Mar-a-Lago. There must be a connection between the two. And you actually, I think, tried to disabuse us of that. Will you tell us a little bit about this piece that you also did some research for? Because I think it's important for people to know it's easy to jump to a conclusion, but that conclusion may not be accurate.
Yes, and that piece was mostly written by some colleagues at ProPublica. We were all trying to get information about what was happening in every state. So I was kind of looking at what was happening in Texas in terms of that. But I think what they found is that overall there's not enough to go around, right? And how supplies, emergency supplies are distributed, it's very complex and it depends on a lot more factors. You know, no one, I think in short, hardly anyone is getting everything they're asking for or what they need. And I think that that's the big overall problem that we're seeing.
So as I was reading the piece, one of the things I thought was interesting, and I don't know whether the reporters at ProPublica sort of played this out, but the governor of Florida has been somewhat reluctant to sort of embrace the problem here. We saw them swimming at the beaches and whatever, and still going to the restaurants, despite the fact that everybody was talking about, you know, community spread and everything else. Is it possible that another reason why the governor of Florida received everything he wanted was that he doesn't really appreciate how deadly this is? That if he had asked for, you know, a couple of million masks, if he had asked for, you know, a couple of, you know, thousands of ventilators, he probably would have gotten a third of that. But what he asked for versus what he may ultimately need is a very different thing based on his gubernatorial leadership perception of the problem his state will face.
It could be, you know, to be honest, I'm not as familiar with Florida. I know here in Texas, the local governments continue talking about the not getting everything they actually need. I know the Governor Abbott actually has called on the federal government also for more help because they don't have anywhere else to turn. So I know that every state has different need, and also governors, depending on how seriously they see this, you know, they're requesting that, but unfortunately I don't have much more insight for Florida.
Well, so let's go to Texas. When you decided to do the research for this article for ProPublica, is it that did you go to the cities to ask them about their requests, or did you go to the governor to ask for the request? Where is the leadership happening in Texas? Who's making the ask? One of the things that we keep hearing from the not president, but who sort of acts like a president, Andrew Cuomo, is that he feels like everyone's competing with everyone else, that the states are competing with each other, the cities are competing with each other, there is no leadership coming out of Washington. So even if you're asking Washington, that doesn't preclude you from assuming that you're sort of on your own, Jack, and asking. So as you were doing the story in Texas, did you see that it was leadership coming from Governor Abbott's office, or was it a Houston mayor asking? Or was it an El Paso person asking? Where did you really see the asks actually taking place and the sense of frustration being more vocal in sort of expressing their concern?
I mean, I think it's here in Texas, it's more at the state level, but at the same time, that's one of the biggest issues we're facing, that disinformation is very hard to come by. There's no centralized, you know, I think some states, actually they were using Florida as an example of all the information they're putting out. In Texas, we have a lot more limited information. So I was asking, you know, the county, the Houston mayor, I was asking the governor's office, and it's very hard to even gauge at exactly what they're requesting, what they're getting, when they're getting it. There's reports of delayed shipments, for instance. So I think that's part of the issue states, such as, you know, we have 254 counties in Texas, for instance.
I know.
It is a big problem for the, I think, for the response side, but also in the reporting side, which is what I'm doing. So it's not a, unfortunately, there's not one single place where you're finding this information is readily available. I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
So what I find interesting is that when you go to the state of Washington, what you see with the state of Washington, which was one of the first places to be sort of, they were the original epicenter, and then obviously now it's New York. But one of the things you saw with Washington, and I was wondering if you could sort of fill me in on Texas, was that there was a since they couldn't rely on the federal government was still sort of in this collective denial stage, but because of the tech industry there, because of Silicon Valley, because there were so many people, so many headquarters there, they saw a huge response from the private sector, because the private sector realized this is their home, these are their people. In a way, this is their state. They don't necessarily own it, but they kind of feel like they do. And so you saw a lot of support coming in from these companies. As we look at Texas, I know that Texas has diversified. It used to be all oil. And they realized that that was not a good thing, especially now when it's probably dropping below $20 a barrel. They're pretty glad they've diversified. Not that they're still not very reliant on the oil and gas industry. But are we seeing the fairly affluent and successful business community recognizing some of the problems? And what we saw duplicate, you know, happening in the state of Washington, are they stepping up? Are they jumping in? So if there's failure from maybe the governor's office, or if there's failure from Washington, they recognize the immediacy of the problem, and they're trying to sort of come up with some of their own sort of private sector solutions. Are we seeing anything like that in Texas?
I think you might see some individual efforts more on the philanthropical side. Or for example, here in Houston, I think a company of switching over to making hand sanitizer because there's a shortage, or you hear the stories about the mask. But in terms of when it comes to testing itself and supplies, I think it is still very limited to what the government is doing. And I was having a conversation with the Harris County judge, for instance, and she said that they very early on realized when they were trying to get some of the supplies on their own, that there wasn't a place where they could go, a private sector where they could go and get the supplies, and realize very early on that they would have to be relying on the federal government to get the supplies and test kits they needed to run the government testing sites.
So it sounds like the Harris County judge, I've been following, obviously, because it's Houston, I've been following her. And one of the things I found fascinating was that, so she has tried to sort of do a shelter in place or some variation on that theme for Harris County. Of course, that seems to be so impossible when you're part of Texas and part of 50 states, because how do you do that? Of course, Governor Abbott wants to sort of tell people that are coming in from Louisiana and coming in from New York that they have to, you know, quarantine themselves. And it said, so if they fly in, they quarantine, but if they drive in, they don't have to, because you don't know they arrived. But what I did see, which was so shocking, was that there was actually even a legal challenge to the Harris County judge by a GOP activist and three ministers, basically claiming that this was a First Amendment challenge and you couldn't do this and this was unconstitutional. Is she getting support from the governor on this one? Is the indicted attorney general coming to her aid in order to make sure that even if the state isn't doing it, what she is doing is trying to protect the health and safety of Harris County residents?
Actually, the governor issued some more directives yesterday, and in his directive, he exempted religious, houses of worship, for instance. So there's still right now, we're actually following up on that right now and see what that means for counties such as Harris County that did not exclude houses of worship. So right now that's still being interpreted and analyzed to see what impact does Abbott order have on counties such as Harris County.
So that means that you can't congregate if you're in business. You can't congregate if you're an academic institution, but if you're looking for Jesus, then you can congregate because they are exempt, even though they get sick, even though they go back into the community, even though they will tax the medical staff, but somehow because it has a religious rationale for it, they're exempt?
It would have to be to follow the social distancing guidelines, for instance, but that is to, you know, we're actually looking into that right now of what does that mean in practice? Are these churches that filed the lawsuit that you mentioned, are they going to hold services or not? And if so, how many people are going to attend? How are they going to be dealing with the social distancing? All of that remains to be seen.
Unbelievable. And has he been challenged on this, Governor Abbott, this exemption? And frankly, I would sue the governor on this, but I would sue the governor if I was a hospital worker. I would sue the governor if I was a nurse or a doctor, because the concern I would have is if you're exempting this. One of our regular guests is a guy named Scott Braddock, who's the editor of the Quorum Report. And as Scott said, it just adds to the confusion. Because if you're telling people that you need to sort of social distance and you need to shelter in place, and yet, you know, you're still allowing religious institutions, which are obviously very important to people who obviously, especially, as he said, especially older people who really see church as a very, very important place for them to go, and yet they're the most vulnerable. In a lot of ways, you've opened your doors, not necessarily just to faith, but to a spread of a disease.
And just to be clear, a lot of the faith communities that reporters have reached out to have said they will continue virtual services and will not hold life. But you know, it's something to definitely keep an eye on.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's going to be a confusing time. And obviously what's happening at the detention centers is of great concern to a lot of people, whether it's, you know, the detention centers, as you pointed out, in Florida or Louisiana or Texas. These people came here because they were concerned about persecution. And then when they landed here, it should never have been a death sentence. And I'm just terrified that may be what it ends up being. And that was never, I think, at least should never have been our intent. So Perla, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And keep writing for ProPublica. They're a valuable news institution. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao. Change.